Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is Nicole Hannah-Jones, creator of the 1619 Project from the New York Times Magazine. The project makes a case that you don't often hear in history textbooks, that slavery was foundational to America. So it wasn't surprising that we ignited a fierce debate among historians about these issues. But that's the power of the New York Times, to spark an important dialogue with bold, rigorous reporting that forces us to examine our assumptions. To learn more, go to nytimes.com/worth it.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 13th of February, we're bringing you an insider's view of the coronavirus. We hear from a woman trapped on a quarantine cruise ship. The major shakeup in the Italian parliament as right-wing politician Matteo Salvini faces a trial for illegally detaining migrants. How a Russian man shot himself dead in the middle of a packed courtroom, and which household name brands have been declared to have an illegal hand in Israeli settlements. Also in this podcast,
the world does have a carbon budget. It is finite and it is running out fast.
Another big business pledge to reduce carbon emissions, but this time from an unlikely sector, the fossil fuel industry. An enemy that does not respect borders. Words from the World Health Organization's Director General about COVID-19, the latest strain of the coronavirus. Speaking to a packed news conference in Geneva, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus had a warning.
The number of newly confirmed cases reported from China has stabilized over the past week. But that must be interpreted with extreme caution. This outbreak could still go in any direction.
The highly contagious virus continues to disrupt lives and events worldwide. Let's go to the WHO headquarters in Geneva now, where hundreds of top medical, scientific and public health experts have just held a 2-day meeting. Our correspondent there is Imogen Folks.
There are some kind of glimmers of optimism. You heard Dr. Tedros there. I mean, he's cautioning, he's asking for extreme caution. But there is this feeling that the cases in China, when they talk about stabilization, what they mean is that the number of new cases each day that's announced is getting lower. And that this is a sign, they hope, that they're beginning to contain it in China. The other bit of what sounds like possible good news is that outside China, there are still very few cases. Almost all of them can be tracked. The WHO knows where they came from. Mostly it's people who've been in China or associated with. And in addition, the virus outside China doesn't seem, we heard, to be as aggressive or to move as quickly. So that sounds good. But before we all relax, What the WHO is saying is be cautious. It still could go anyway, people have got to prepare, not panic, but prepare.
It's a delicate line they have to take, isn't it? Because on the one hand, they want people to be ready and prepared, but they don't want to cause panic either.
That's right. It's always, the WHO is always in this dilemma when we get a disease outbreak, particularly today with the kind of modern information technology that we have. You or I can get a headline or access information, some of it reliable, much of it not, at the click of a button. And it's very, very hard sometimes for the WHO to counter this. Interestingly, with the scientists who met today, they set their priorities for this virus. And obviously, treatments, diagnostics, looking at a vaccine in the long term are up there in the high priorities. But so too is tackling what they call the infodemic. This flood of false information about this virus, which is causing people to panic, causing cruise ships to be turned away from ports, even though there isn't a shred of evidence that anybody on it has the virus. The WHO is trying hard to counter that.
Imogen, folks. Now, one of those cruise ships affected has been confirmed as the largest outbreak outside China. It's in Japan, or at least in Japanese waters, and called the Diamond Princess, quarantined in the port of Yokohama. There are 39 new cases on board, bringing the total number to 175, and it is quite an operation dealing with the patients, as well as those passengers not afflicted by the virus, but who have to stay put. One passenger, Catherine Smith, told us what it's like being stuck on board.
We literally can't leave our cabin, so we go out on the balcony. Before we had a view of the harbor, and today we're looking down at the dock. It's very creepy because I counted the ambulances that are sitting out there, and there's at least a dozen ambulances that are just parked. And then closer to the ship, there are two ambulances that are idling. And there's these long covered tunnel-like things. And there's people in, you know, full hazmat garb. There's two people in full-on military uniforms that then have masks and a gown over them, like a hospital gown. When they're ready to actually transport the people that have the virus, the ambulance, all the sirens come with three or four emergency vehicles. They come in and they park by the canopy area. And then an ambulance will back up. And then at that point, I assume they open the doors and they load the people in. And then when they're ready to leave, all the emergency vehicles put their sirens on again and they drive out. And so that's been going on all day. It's really disturbing because I know those people are only sick to me, as in they have the flu. I know this isn't The Walking Dead and people aren't, you know, zombies, but it makes a real impression on you. All of a sudden, I felt really lonely standing out there, you know, with my mask on, going like, this is my world for another week. Since 8 a.m. last Wednesday, we were ordered into our cabins, and that's where you stay. And you cannot leave unless you're under that supervised group that's allowed out onto certain decks for an hour at a time. And they're watched by Japanese health officials to make sure everybody's following the rules.
Catherine Smith. The Italian Senate has stripped the former Interior Minister, Matteo Salvini, of the standard parliamentary immunity in a move that means he'll now stand trial for his decision whilst in office to ban rescued migrants from landing at an Italian port. During the debate, Mr. Salvini, leader of the populist Anti-Migrant League, evoked nationalist sentiments.
If defending Italy, its honour, dignity and security is the duty of a politician, or a crime that deserves up to 15 years in prison, that's what I want a final decision to be taken on in this surreal debate.
Matteo Salvini, our correspondent in Rome, Mark Lowen, looks at the future facing Italy's firebrand populist leader.
Matteo Salvini's 15 months as Italy's interior minister were defined by his flagship policy to close ports to rescue boats. Prosecutors argued his order last July to stop a boat from docking, leaving 116 migrants on board in dire conditions, amounted to illegal detention. Italy's Senate has now stripped the far-right leader of his immunity, paving the way for a trial. For a man who has built his political rise on the idea of protecting Italy from illegal migration, a populist who presents himself as targeted by the establishment, this has played into his hands. If convicted, Matteo Salvini could face a sentence of up to 15 years. But justice here moves slowly, and he might just take comfort from his predecessor as Italy's populist-in-chief, Silvio Berlusconi, who had his sentence for fraud commuted and then made a very Italian comeback, becoming a member of the European Parliament.
Mark Lowen, the young generation in India still see the UK as a desirable place to study, and it may be that Brexit could open the door to more student places. As it is, the latest data shows a 63% rise in Indian student visas granted by the United Kingdom. But with costs running into many thousands of dollars, can they expect to see a return on their investment? From Mumbai, the BBC's Monica Miller reports.
For many families, sending one child to college requires major sacrifices. But the Bamanis are sending two children to UK universities. Bhavya is heading to Coventry University for architecture.
My friends are already there. My brother was also planning for the same. I have my aunt who is an architect there, so she also recommended me that the UK practice for architecture is very good if you get that exposure.
She has a good reason to be optimistic. In the wake of Brexit, EU students will no longer be given preferential treatment when they apply to colleges in Britain, letting international students compete on a level playing field. The British High Commission says more than 30,000 Indian students received higher education visas for the year ending in September 2019. That's compared to almost 19,000 the previous year. Her brother, Kaval, is getting a master's degree in supply chain management at Sheffield Hallam University. He says the British university ticked all the boxes for him.
I had applied in 2 to 3 colleges, but Sheffield Hallam was my first preference, probably just because of the city, maybe the modules and college review as well.
But will the divorce between the United Kingdom and the European Union put a kink in their long-term plans?
No. Right now, my focus is more about my education of 2 years.
But there's no point in, you know, getting a placement in my course if I don't have a good job. So I'm concerned about it, but let's hope for the best.
More than 200 applicants stopped by this suburban Mumbai office to meet with recruiters from universities all over the UK. And they decorated it with flags from the United Kingdom, a Big Ben life-size version, which people are taking selfies with, to take some of the pressure off this important moment for these potential students. Now, it's not just the students that are looking to go to the UK. It's also the recruiters from these universities that really need Indian students to apply.
So it's not just about the students, it's also about the faculty and the staff members. Those kinds of challenges would be there in the coming year. It can have an impact on research.
Recruiter Banu Kaushik from the University of Hertfordshire says his college is preparing for a potential loss in enrollment.
Getting new talent, the fresh talent from around the world, can make up, but then it's going to take some time.
Diplomacy experts like Ambassador Rajiv Bhatia from the think tank Gateway House says that the legal framework outlining the future of UK immigration is unclear. But India has had a special relationship with the UK for generations.
In the likelihood of British leaving the EU, there would be a kind of a gap in skilled labor, skilled personnel in the UK. And in that kind of situation, India would be in a very good position.
Consultancy services focused on preparation for international colleges have also been impacted by the rush of students wanting to head to Britain in the past year. Bhaktawar Krishnan is the founder of Inspirus Education. She says she has seen a shift in interest from the United States.
This is now a diagram by which you have labeled. For example, it can be numbers 11, 12, 13, or you may have...
So US, unfortunately, it is the perceived thing that you won't get a work visa. There's a lot of perception and a lot of fear among students. A lot of noise in that space, thinking you won't get a... So there is a lot of uncertainty, let's put it that way. Whereas UK is definitely giving you that work permit.
Brexit will see a fog of uncertainty hanging over the United Kingdom for weeks, if not years to come. In the meantime, students hope Britain will look to a young, driven talent from abroad to lead them to a brighter future.
Monica Miller reporting. Still to come in this podcast. Would you meet a deceased loved one if you could using virtual reality? How one company is using the technology to try and revolutionize the grieving process. International businesses including Airbnb and Expedia have been included on a UN list of companies with activities in Israeli settlements in the West Bank, which are deemed illegal under international law. The UN Human Rights Council report was requested in 2016 and so long delayed. So how important is it now? Our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher, told me more.
This has been announced just a week or two after the Trump Middle East peace plan was finally unveiled. And in that plan, essentially, it gave the green light to Israel to annex the settlements. Now, this has been a long-standing international element of the status quo that, you know, whatever anyone says about Israel, the settlements are internationally regarded as illegal, and that hasn't been challenged. But now that has essentially been through this peace plan. So from a Palestinian perspective, this is welcome that this has appeared now, because in a sense, it gives them a feeling that that international unity on this issue still exists, that the UN is still holding by it. For Israel, as they've said throughout the process, this goes back almost 4 years now, that this is essentially a blacklist, that it's unfair, that it's devoid of the reality of the situation. As far as the companies that are involved, Airbnb you mentioned, now they did actually withdraw from the Israeli areas in the occupied West Bank, where settlers had been advertising their rooms on Airbnb. But under pressure, they went back in. So in the immediate terms, nothing much is going to happen about those businesses. But the boycott movement will obviously continue to try to target them. And that could have some effect on their international reputation, which, you know, is a concern for them.
Sebastian Usher. The new boss of oil giant BP has set an ambitious target for the multinational to become a net zero emitter of greenhouse gases by 2050. Bernard Looney also called for the sector to be reimagined.
The big challenge for BP is the one that the world faces, and that is climate change. But the reality is we are seen by many as a source of the problem, and worse still, an obstacle to solving it. And that's an uncomfortable place to be, and let me be very clear today that I get it. The world does have a carbon budget. It is finite and it is running out fast.
So who is Bernard Looney and what's he trying to achieve? Our business editor, Simon Jack, told my colleague Nigel Cassidy about him.
He is a 49-year-old Irishman. He spent most of his career in BP's oil and gas exploration division, which used to head, and that's the bit that's most controversial, if you like, trying to find new stuff to burn. And he's setting out what they've described as a landmark speech, saying that BP will become a net zero emissions company by 2050 or sooner. And they say that over time, they'll put more into low carbon and less into oil and gas production.
For as long as most of us can remember, oil companies have been the mainstay of people's investments, and yet we keep hearing that the ethical thing is not to invest in these kind of companies. So BP has to do something, doesn't it? Otherwise, it's going to just see a sort of slow decline.
Yeah, there's definitely a movement among investors to try and apply pressure on companies to do something about climate change. Pension funds are demanding that their portfolios are a bit more climate friendly. Larry Fink from BlackRock, the boss of the world's biggest fund manager, they run $7 trillion in money. They've been writing to these companies saying, you've got to do something, otherwise your financial performance will decline and we simply won't invest in you unless you shape up. Having said that, Shell and BP pay some very, very hefty dividends, which pension funds very much like.
So this guy comes from the inside. Do you think that's an advantage, or might it be that BP needs an entirely new vision?
That's a good question. I mean, you could apply that to almost any company. The old argument here is that the insiders know where the dead bodies are and what needs to be changed. And clearly he's got vast experience in the oil and gas exploration field, which is the bit that they need to reduce. So is he going to turn on his old division and start stripping it back? You know, you could argue where his loyalties lie. But I think this is a pretty fundamental reboot. The idea of an oil and gas company saying it's going to be net zero carbon by 2050, I think it's going to be very, very difficult. For example, they say we're going to cut the carbon intensity of the products BP sells. Now, I don't quite know what that means, but the thing is, there's been some real progress made in things like electricity generation. That is now 30% in the UK generated by renewables. Coal has all but disappeared. The big problem is gas. Gas heats 26 million homes in Britain. If you're going to replace all of those, that'll cost £500 billion by the government's own estimates. And that is the biggest challenge out there. So he's going to make a defence of gas, saying that if you get this thing called carbon capture and storage, which means you capture the carbon at the point it's burnt, you can then put it into solid and put it in the depleted oil fields in the North Sea, which by happy coincidence we've got lots of near the UK. If we can get that right, bring hydrogen in, because if you burn hydrogen you just get water, that could be exported to the rest of the world.
Our business editor, Simon Jack. Commentators are also making quite a thing of the fact that, unusually for a global business chief, Mr. Looney has started posting on Instagram. He's clearly ready to face a high level of engagement from industry friends and foes alike. Next, a story that's been dominating Russian media, that of a former prison service official who killed himself in the middle of a courtroom. Vitaly Shevchenko from BBC Monitoring, the part of the BBC that analyzes other countries' media, told my colleague Nuala McGovern who this man was.
He used to head the road transport department at Russia's prison service called FSIN. So at shortly after 1 o'clock Moscow time, he was in the courtroom, he was a defendant, and as the judge was delivering the sentence, this man called Viktor Sviridov, he pulled out a gun and shot himself right in the courtroom.
Okay, a lot of questions there. How could he have had a gun in the courtroom?
Well, that's a question that's being asked in the Russian media. There's really heavy, strict security. You can't just take out a phone and take pictures of what's going on. There's metal detectors, there's security guards everywhere. And this man, he managed to smuggle a gun into the courtroom. So, well, perhaps there's a way, if you are a former official with the prison service. Also, another question, there are more questions than answers currently. Another question that's being asked is, okay, we know that there's a lot of corruption in Russian prisons, there's lots of torture. Would this man have been convicted, and he got 3 years in jail?
I was about to ask, yeah.
Yeah, would this man have been convicted if he had tried to extort money from an ordinary citizen, not a fellow official with the prison service? Again, this is a question to which there's no answer. And the details of what happened are quite grim. There are reports that he had advanced cancer, and even supporters of the Kremlin, I've just read a tweet from the head of Russia Today, the news service, she said, if you have cancer, death is better than serving time in jail.
Vitaly Shevchenko of BBC Monitoring. Virtual reality is already being used within the medical industry to help patients manage physical pain, but could it do the same for emotional pain? One mother in South Korea has used the technology to help her deal with the death of her 7-year-old daughter by bringing an avatar version of her back. The newsroom's Richard Hamilton reports.
Jang Ji-sung's daughter, Na Yeon, died 4 years ago from a rare blood disorder. A production team spent 8 months recreating a three-dimensional image of Na Yeon. The documentary called Meeting You has been watched by millions of South Koreans. This is the emotional moment when they're reunited.
Ma! Oh, Ma! Oh, Ma, where did you go? Oh,
Ma!
엄마, 내 생각했어?
The scene was filmed while the rest of the family watched, and they're visibly upset. But Jang Ji-sung said it helped her. In her dream, she said Na Yong looked sad, but in this virtual reunion, she's smiling. The documentary has prompted a debate about the moral and psychological implications of being able to meet dead loved ones. While some feel it provides catharsis, others think it could prevent people moving on with their lives. Elaine Casket is a grief counsellor and the author of All the Ghosts in the Machine, The Digital Afterlife of Your Personal Data.
This video really needs to be viewed in its Korean context. In Korea, when someone dies away from home or before their time, they can become a wandering ghost, a ghost who dies away from home. And the duty of the family is to usher them into the spirit world with the appropriate rituals. It's part of Korean shamanism. And this video feels to me like a bang-up-to-date virtual reality version of Korean shamanism where this ritual is being enacted.
Towards the end of the film, Na Yeon gives her mother a flower, and then she lies down saying she's tired. The two say their farewells, and Na Yeon slowly falls asleep. She's then transformed into a white butterfly and gently floats away.
Richard Hamilton. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye.